Welcome back, everyone, to this week's episode of Cohen's Corner. We are so excited today to have on a really fun guest, Danielle Sepulveris, who is a huge Mets fan and a freelance writer based out of New York. She mainly covers pop culture and entertainment, women's health, and relationships in her work. And she, like the rest of us, is delusionally convinced that every year will be the year that the Mets win the World Series. And let's hope that this is actually the year. So we're very excited to talk to her. This week, we're going to have a bit of a throwback-focused episode, talk mostly about the 1986 Mets ESPN doc that came out last year, kind of share our thoughts on that. And we're also going to discuss Keith Hernandez getting his number retired, which ties in well with the subject of that documentary. And so we're very excited to talk to her about all of those things, see what else comes up, and kind of discuss our Mets fandom in that way. So Danielle, thank you so much for joining us this week. We're really excited to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, awesome. And actually, so before we get started with the kind of main topics for this week's episode, obviously because of the lockout, there hasn't been a ton going on in Mets land, but the Mets have made some additions to their coaching staff in the past few weeks. They've added their bench coach, who is Glenn Sherlock, will be returning to the team after previously coaching in 2017 through 2019. They also have a few other coaches joining their organization. So we just wanted to mention that. Jake, I don't know if you have any particular thoughts on any new members of the coaching staff. Knock on wood, none of them seem too controversial, which is always nice. So it should be interesting to see how a lot of them seem to have ties to Buck Showalter from his previous managing gig. So it'll be interesting to see how they communicate with the players. I know the Mets also managed to poach Eric Chavez from the Yankees, who was going to be their assistant hitting coach. And now he's going to be the Mets hitting coach. So it's always interesting when those kind of things reverse. I guess they traded Luis Rojas for Eric Chavez. Hopefully that was a good trade. But yeah, Jake, Danielle, do you have any particular thoughts on anyone the Mets have hired for their coaching staff? We figured we may as well bring it up since it did happen, even though luckily wasn't too noteworthy.
Well, I love, is it the bullpen coach with the photo where he's
oh
like,
oh my God, with that crazy smile.
It's the funniest photo. Someone sent it to me. Cause I guess, that, you know, like you said, there's not really much going on obviously because of the lockout in terms of news, but, I guess that happened while I was kind of not online at the moment. And one of my friends in one of the group chats, which is mainly centered around our delusional Mets fandom, had sent the picture of him and was like, have you guys seen this picture? And my response to it was confirmed World Series 2022.
If that guy can bring us a World Series just based on him alone, that'd be great. Yeah, I saw that picture. I was like, this guy looks insane. And then I saw another picture of him just standing normally. I was like, okay. But I hope when he takes his like Mets picture, he better smile like that, or I'm going to be so disappointed.
I know.
I just have a feeling like anytime the bullpen blows a game this year, someone's going to like resurface that photo and be like, this guy is like, I don't know what it is, but you know how some things you just instantly feel like are going to come back. Like, I feel like now that we know that exists, I feel like in some form, if the bullpen does something crazy this year, maybe someone will like tweet that photo. Maybe we will, like, I don't know. We'll see what we can do.
I think it could potentially, I think you're right. Cause I think it could potentially be our version of, you know, that gif of Julia Louis-Dreyfus from Veep where she's like laughing nervously and so like whispering what the fuck to people around her.
It's us being like scared what's about to happen.
Yes.
Maybe
I feel like we can use that picture of him in that in that tone.
Yeah, I think like he was the most entertaining hire at all of them, and I didn't really even know anything about him, but after seeing his picture, I'm like, this guy's really interesting. But no, it's nice that they were finally able to round out their coaching staff. Like you said, Eric Chavez coming from the Yankees, and they gave him a promotion. I think he's a really smart young baseball mind. I mean, we saw what he did as a player, so hopefully he can bring something. And hey, we're trading him for Rojas or however you want to put it, but you know, I was all on board getting rid of Rojas. Yeah, Danielle, I don't know if you know, but I loved Rojas in the beginning, but the decisions he made in the season just made me want to pull my hair out. So I'm very excited to have Buck Showalter as our manager. I've been going nuts about that for a long time, but
yes, but yeah. I think he called it in like literally our first episode. He's like, you know what? Who should manage the Mets? Buck Showalter. And I was like,
that's never going to happen. I was saying that. Yeah.
That's, oh my God, you called it.
But I've tried to call plenty of other things that haven't stuck. So don't act like,
I don't think I've ever successfully predicted anything in terms of, yeah. So we're still waiting on that. Yeah. But
last summer I was on this weird streak of calling who was going to get a hit in the game, but also last season nobody was hitting for the majority of the season. So I almost feel like I just looked at it as, and like, who hasn't hit in the longest? Who like desperately is so due? Like, so
who's statistically
overdue?
Likely to actually get a hit soon?
Everyone. Get a hit tonight. And so there were a few games, because then one of my friends was playing that MLB game where you pick players, and then you win money, like, based on if they do something in that day's games or whatever it is. And in the morning, he would be like, who's going to hit tonight? And I would give him, and he won for like 10 days straight. Wow. And then I'm like, the minute I start playing for myself, though, then I'm going to be wrong and I'm going to lose money. So I'm just going to enjoy this.
Nice.
Yeah, to spread the wealth to
your friends and family. I'm sure they appreciate
it. Bragging rights at that point.
Yeah, definitely. So like we said, there'll be new coaches next year. I do think like it'll be interesting because, you know, obviously when the Mets fired Chili Davis and brought in Hugh Quattlebaum as their hitting coach last year, again, I don't know a ton about like how players feel about hitting coaches, but I have to think maybe now having another former player like Chili Davis as their hitting coach, maybe that will kind of help some of the players going forward next year. They didn't really hit before or after that firing as far, you know, from given the eye test, it didn't seem like it made a huge difference. Right. But I wonder if like having a relatively recent major league player would be an advantage for helping the team's offense next year. Someone who actually had, like Chili Davis, a very kind of successful offensive career for the most part. So I guess it'll be interesting to see how that turns out. I feel like they've tried a few different modes of like, you know, former player who maybe wasn't as analytically inclined versus a coach who is perhaps a lot more analytically inclined. And now maybe they're going like somewhere in between. I'm not really sure, but I don't know. I've been getting good vibes from the people they've hired so far, which means nothing, but we shall see. Maybe it makes more of a difference than we realize. It's hard to know how much, you know, like a first base coach, for example, like actually makes a difference. But I also think just having people that players enjoy kind of players can like talk baseball strategy with, and that actually ends up being helpful. I feel like behind the scenes, sometimes these coaches might have a bigger influence than we realize just on, you know, helping people's mindsets be in the right place. I don't know. So maybe that will happen.
I agree with that. Yeah. Cause there's only so much we can know what's going on in the clubhouse and during practices and all that, you know, like all we see is the product out on the field. And I hate to say that they're human beings. But you know, like the results, I should say. And then if you're not seeing results, like last year we saw, like, so it's last year, I still can't wrap my head around it because it's like, we have so many good young guys and they all had a down year.
The Mets like finished like 27th in runs scored in all of baseball, or like literally terrible. Almost the worst.
Yes. And it was just, and I wasn't used to, I was used to in other years when things are going wrong. It's like, okay, the defense hasn't been good this year. And then, or, you know, these people are injured. Granted, we definitely had injuries too, but when they were fully healthy, they just weren't hitting the ball. I mean, we have Lindor who's, you know, just almost giving up and bunting in games because he can't get a hit, and he's just like desperate to get on base, so he's trying to lay down a bunt, and you're like, oh my god, how is this happening to us? But you know, very
yeah
nice.
I respect the
hustle, but also it killed my soul a little bit every time he bunted, especially with like from like the two hole. I'm like, no.
Don't do it. And then
you're it's the Mets curse. I mean, we get this big super, and I'm sure he'll be better this year, but you get that big superstar and he disappoints. I mean, anybody could have predicted this, but I guess with Steve Cohen, we were kind of hoping maybe things are different. We got rid of that Wilpon stink, you know? So, but I mean, I don't know. I love what Cohen's doing so far. I mean, he's putting his best foot forward. So it's not anything we can really say the Wilpons did the last 10 years they own the team. So at least he's doing that. But yeah, you're right. The young hitters just, I think Dom Smith in the short 2020 season, he basically led the league in extra base hits. He was unreal. And then last year he hit what, like 250? Like Dom Smith should be a gap-to-gap 300 hitter. And he was just one example of a player that didn't perform, not even like he didn't, it was just a little below what we expected. It wasn't even close to what we expected from all of them. McNeil, Conforto, I mean, the list goes on and on.
Yeah. I think McNeil will have a much better year this year. I was just about to say Michael Conforto, but Michael Conforto's gone.
I think McNeil might be gone too. I think they might trade him.
Yeah, I think McNeil might go. I want, and also I always like go back and forth because I love Dom Smith so much, but I also feel like he deserves to play every day, and he doesn't do that with us. He
No, and
doesn't
he
get to
deserves
do
to play
that.
at his natural position. You know what I mean? Like that's gotta
Yes.
that definitely I think feel like hurts his offense that he's I mean he has become way better left fielder than when he started. Like I
Yes.
admire him so much for what he's been able to like how much better he's been able to get in the outfield.
What a good
But
teammate he's
still,
been for
yeah.
like putting in all the work
Yes.
in the
Exactly.
outfield.
But still he's a first baseman. Like that's what he is. And
Yes.
he's a better first baseman than Pete Alonso, but I mean obviously with the DH coming, who knows? But I don't
Yeah.
think they're gonna sit Pete Alonso every day because Alonso's not gonna want that. And that could
No.
affect his game, but I agree with you. I mean, I love Dom Smith, but if
Yeah.
they're not going to be able to find a way for him to play every day, they got to trade him. But I feel like last year his value was the highest. Are you going to trade him now and after he hit
Yeah.
250? I don't know.
Yes. I know I was at the game at the end of 2019 before the world
Oh.
shut down in 2020,
Oh.
where he hit that 3-run blast
Yeah.
to bring them back.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was a game that didn't matter. It was last game of the season. Like both them and the Braves were completely long out of it. But I was at the games all that weekend because I was hoping to see Pete break the record, which he had done. I guess he had done that on Friday or Saturday. Now
I
I
think
can't
he did it
remember.
like with
He
one or
did
two
it. He
games
did
left
it.
in
I
the
was there. It
season.
was the Saturday night.
Saturday, right. Okay, so he did it on the Saturday, and then I had tickets for the Sunday for the last game too. And so, if, you know, I was like, well, I saw him break, but you know, it's always fun to go the last game of the season. I'm so glad I did because getting to see Dom like come off the bench after like 3 months on the injured list and then just like blast one after because we were winning that game, then we were losing that game, and it was so like
Echevarria hit
Yeah,
like two
remember
home
Denny
runs in
hit
that game.
Echevarria. Yeah,
Like,
like what's going on?
yes. And I was like, no, why is this happening to us on the last day? It's because, you know, you hate ending the season that way because it's just such a
On a whimper,
down,
yeah.
crappy feeling. Yes. I mean, it was bad enough we had to suffer through the year earlier when we were playing the Marlins for David Wright's
Oh
final
no.
game. And that game just went on
Thirteen
forever. And it
innings.
was just
Oh,
like, and
horrible.
I'm like, oh my God, just roll over, Marlins. Just roll over. It's not your day. Like, let us have
This is not
this.
about you, Miami
It's
Marlins. Yeah.
always the pesky Marlins. I swear to God, it is
Always.
always the Marlins. They've always been so bad, but when we play them, it's like it's
The
unreal.
world beaters all of a sudden.
Oh,
Yeah.
they do. They somehow turn into Tampa Bay when we play them. I
They
don't
do.
understand it.
They get some of
Ever.
that good mojo from slightly farther north, exactly.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, anyway, Danielle, moving on to the main topic of this episode. Actually, before we do that, I do want to ask you, this is something we often ask, you know, all of our guests that come on. I do want to kind of ask like how you first got into following the Mets slash became a Mets fan. You know, everyone always has like slightly different stories. If there was like a season that kind of stuck out to you in terms of you know, making you interested in baseball or a player or how that began. So before we kind of dive into the 86 Mets doc, what is kind of your Mets origin story?
So my family is a baseball family, and my grandfather was a huge Brooklyn Dodgers fan and was one of those people that you read about in the history books who was completely devastated when they left for LA and, you know, had cousins who would go to Yankee games, and he's like, I can't go to Yankee games after I've hated them for the last however many years. So when the Mets came along, they became his team. And you know, therefore it became my dad's team, which then became being my brother's team as you know, you're sort of born into it. I remember my first game was in 1987, so it was a year after they had won the World Series. So I remember a very excited feeling. I was very young. I remember a very excited feeling in the stands. I was probably I had to be about 6. So I only have like very kind of vague, blurry memories of it, but I remember everyone being very, very excited because it was spring, and you know they had won the World Series last year, and they still had all these players from you know returning, and they were like determined to do it again, or And so I remember everyone screaming for Daryl Strawberry, except they were saying Strawberry and like everyone's clapping. And I was tugging on my dad's sleeve and I said, "Dad, what's Strawberry's last name?" Because I didn't know that you called the players by their last name, that that was a thing. And everyone around heard me ask and thought it was so funny. "Oh, this cute little kid, that Strawberry was his first name." And I decided, because I was six and I liked strawberries, that he was my favorite player. I was like, "This guy, Strawberry, yeah, he's the best." And everybody's always cheering for him. So I was a big Daryl Strawberry girl in the 80s. And then, yeah, I always, my dad brought us to games. And then in the 90s, when I was in high school, almost everyone was a Yankee fan. I grew up in New Jersey. Everyone was a Yankee fan. The Yankees were very good at that point. So it was part, you know, Yankee fans and part front runners. Like, this is, you know, this is the team in New York. Like, Mets are terrible. Mets are a joke. Anybody who likes the Mets, like, you know, is a loser. And so it's because of peer pressure, it's really hard to hold on to your fandom.
It requires a certain personal strength that being a Yankee fan just doesn't require. And that's just what it is.
Yes. And then when I was in college, they played the Yankees in the World Series. But I remember the game that they won to go to the World Series, and I was a sophomore and I was running up and down the hallway like slamming my fists on everyone's door, just like screaming and being like, "Woo!" And I got written up by the resident advisor for I don't even know what you were, just like the overly loud behavior or something like that.
Worth it, I think.
Totally worth it. But then, of course, you know, was not great when they lost the World Series. You know, and yeah, I guess I just every year become more and more entrenched in this fandom, because can't give up on them now.
Entrenched or delusional? What?
A little bit entrenched, of trapped.
I've been trying to talk to myself.
Stuck in quicksand. Yeah.
I have any mental problems.
It's more of I do talk to my therapist a lot about it, because sometimes I would have therapy on like on a day I was going to a game, so I'd come and I'd be wearing like my DeGrom sweatshirt and a hat, and he's like, "Oh, you're going to the game today?" And I would just launch into this, "You know what I'm mad about?" And it would be about the last night's game.
I can't like have a baseball conversation without talking about Jacob DeGrom at some point. It's like, actually, it just happens every time. I don't know what it is, because I always just subconsciously figure out a way to like mention him, and then whoever's responding, who, if they like baseball, then they'll like have something else to say about it. I really try not to, because I know I like bother people about it, but it just ends up happening like most of the time. They'll be like, "Oh, this pitcher had a really good year, blah blah blah," and I'll be like, "Remember when DeGrom had like that amazing year in 2018 when he led the league?" Like, it just always ends up happening. So it happens on the podcast too, by the way, which I realize I just did right now. So I will.
It's allowed.
Fine. If there's any place to talk about Jacob DeGrom, it's
right. I try to get at least like 3 to 4 minutes of DeGrom discourse in every episode, whether Jake knows it or not. But
this is a safe DeGrom.
It's a safe space. Thank you. So since you weren't quite in your Mets fandom yet when 1986 happened, but you were around. And
I was alive.
Exactly. And you experienced a lot of the players kind of from that era. So I'm kind of curious to hear maybe then how your opinion on the documentary might have been the same as or different from ours. So let's dive right into that, because first of all, when this was announced like 2 years ago, I was super excited about it and was kind of counting down the days. So I guess we can kind of go through, I have a lot of different like points and things I thought about the doc that I would love to bring up, but I guess maybe we could start with, Jake and Danielle, like what are all of our favorite, or I guess like our general thoughts were just having watched it, either, you know, things you noticed the most, things you found the most interesting. Maybe we can start with that and then just see where that goes.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's a good question, because there's so much good stuff in there. I would say one thing that, I mean, I loved a lot about it. There was a lot I didn't know about the series leading up to the World Series, about the NLCS. So a lot of that's up. Like, I mean, I knew about it, but like getting to see more clips and stuff and them talking about it, I realized there was a lot that I didn't know. Because I feel like so much of what we know about Mets lore is about that game that changed everything in Boston when the ball rolls by Bill Buckner. And that's the story that everybody knows about that series, but there's so many other little stories like buried along the way. And so I thought that was really cool to see all of that. But I think my favorite part was, and also heartbreaking part, was Dwight Gooden. And he's such a good speaker on it. Like he's so kind of open about what he went through and how he felt about it. And I would watch another documentary, literally just him talking about everything that happened with him, because there's so much obviously that they didn't even get into that, you know, if you've read other books, like if you've read Devin Gordon's book and others of just about that time. And he was this 19-year-old superstar and they didn't take care of him. And it's like, obviously it doesn't seem like he blames them in any way, but I do. And I don't know. I think that he was sort of thrown to the wolves a little bit, and that becomes obvious. And I mean, both him and Daryl, there's a part in it that says that Frank Cashin said that Daryl and Dwight let New York down for leaving when they eventually left. And I don't know, I just thought that was so, like, that's not how it works. Like, they're players. They, you know, they go, they get contracts. And sometimes those contracts are with other teams. And if you're not treating them well on their team and another team's offering them a better deal and more money, of course they're going to go. And I don't know, that bothered me, the whole they deserted New York or they let New York down, because I think that it reminds me a lot of stuff that bothers me today when it feels like a player is getting thrown under the bus for something. You know, I guess kind of like the big deal they made about Javi with a thumbs down thing this year. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, team morale is down because Javi Baez is doing the thumbs down to fans. And now like the players are anti-fans or so. I don't know. It just like felt like a very sort of non-story that became a story and then just took on a life of its own. And I don't know, that was going on around the time that I watched the documentary. So a lot of that was in my head about how some things haven't changed.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, obviously we're a part of the media, but the media is always also looking for, like, grasping for straws sometimes for something to kind of throw out and throw a player to the wolves. And I feel like Baez in that situation, like, it really, like, yes, it shouldn't happen. And it was somewhat disrespectful to fans for him to do that. And yeah, but like, I feel like it got blown so far out of proportion. And I mean, look at what the Knicks, Julius Randle did basically the exact same thing a couple weeks ago. And it got talked about, but not nearly to the level that Baez was scrutinized, like not nearly. And Randall's been here as a New York Knick, and he's had success, like, and he knows how it goes with the fans. Baez was only here for a few weeks, so, like, you know what I mean? Like, we don't even know the guy that well, so maybe that's...
He wasn't under contract with the Mets for this season either, you know, at that time.
Like, I feel like, especially even with the Mets, like, things just tend to get blown so much further out of proportion than they need to be, and these players just get vilified, and it's just, it's not necessary. And I agree with you, back in the 80s, I didn't know this, but now from watching the doc and seeing all that, and obviously... Doc Gooden brought some of that stuff on himself doing the drugs. But I think, yeah, it definitely could have been prevented if they handled – because he was a kid, if the team could have handled him in a better way. And it's so evident in that, just like watching, like even in the first episode, they talk about it and they show how Doc was – he was a 19-year-old in the All-Star game. And like that's how him and Gary Carter kind of developed their relationship before Carter came to the Mets. I'm like, wow, like 19, like when Juan Soto came up, right, and he was 19 and it was a big hype. But imagine like a pitcher, a phenom like that at the age of 19, like that's incredible. And you got to have so many things on your plate. And I can just imagine the things that were going through his head. And now, I mean, growing up, I was like, wow, this guy, I'd see him in a different light that, oh, he did drugs, he did this. But now that I think about everything and how much he had on his plate, like it wasn't an easy lifestyle for Doc Gooden to live, you know?
Yeah, I felt so, like he's clearly had gone to therapy and all that stuff. Otherwise, I don't think he would have been able to talk so openly in the documentary about, you know, what, like the fact that he missed the parade.
That's crazy.
Through the parade. Like,
there's just a twinge of sadness to like a lot of even happy Mets events, mm-hmm. which I always feel like, you know, even like Tom Seaver's career. Oh, but he was traded and wasn't a Met his whole career. You know, he didn't throw no hitter with the Mets and didn't win a three. Like there's always, I feel like there's not one player in Mets history that from beginning to end is a fairy tale. And even the 86 thing, you're right. There's like a twinge of
the dynasty did not continue like people thought it would, even though they were good for the rest of the decade. But yeah, even, you know, things like that, where they like trading Kevin Mitchell for in the offseason right afterwards, Doc Gooden and Daryl Strawberry not having the, you know, Hall of Fame careers that people might have predicted. There's always just like a, and maybe we just bring this on ourselves as Mets fans, like to find these like twinges of sadness and things. But it is even interesting, like the tone of the documentary after they won the World Series was not jubilant. It was kind of like melancholy almost in a way.
It's also, I can't believe Keith going and sitting down in the clubhouse because he was so mad and like thought the game was over. And then, but then I was laughing because of the part where he's like, well, the, like hits are happening while I'm sitting in this chair. So I can't leave this chair while hits are happening.
That was such a relatable moment. Or like,
yes.
Like
me every game. Yeah.
It probably means nothing, but I feel like in my head it's doing something.
Yes.
It's nice that Keith feels that way.
Right. You're like, wait, I got up to get a drink and then all of a sudden Pete Alonso got a hit, so I should stay in the kitchen right now until like until they stop hitting.
Exactly. But speaking to Keith, I mean, in my eyes, like I think after watching the documentary, I think Keith was the heart and soul of that team, and he really was kind
he was
of
such an incredible group. Leader I feel that's like that great. Everyone just yeah. he was the center yeah. of the action,
and it's yeah. so cool to like hear him talk about how his dad kind of brought it to his attention that the Mets had these up and coming prospects and how good Strawberry was going to be and how good Doc was in the minors. Because when Keith was thinking if he was going to re-sign or not, that his dad kind of said that, like, you got to see this young talent they have coming. And I feel like that kind of played a big role in Keith staying. And imagine if Keith had decided to leave, I don't think we'd be having this conversation about any of this right now. And
no.
I just think obviously with his jersey being retired, and we'll talk about more of that later on. But I just think the Doc really showed like, how much of a leader he was. Now he's saying he started taking the team, like when they'd have away games, he would take all the guys to the bar at the hotel after the game just to talk about their at-bats. He just wanted to talk about like what was going on through their head. I just think like knowing that, like he really held that team together.
Yeah. That's, and I'm sad that we don't still have Gary Carter with us.
Yeah.
Because I think, I'm sure, well, we'll get to retiring the jersey, but Gary is one of my picks to be retired as well. But seeing him in the doc was so funny because I've always more heard about him than have any memory of him really playing because I was so young when he was on the team. But he has like such a Nimmo like energy.
I wrote an article exactly about this because I had like barely heard him talk, to be honest, like throughout my life so far. And that was kind of one of my takeaways was like, oh my God, I love Gary Carter. And also I feel like, and obviously I know he's no longer alive, but I feel like one of my very slight gripes with this documentary, and again, maybe just virtue of who is still around and who isn't, I feel like they could have used more Gary Carter and slightly less Lenny Dykstra. Like, no offense to Lenny. I feel like there was a little, like, too much of him.
He was entertaining, though.
He was. But I feel like there could, I felt like Gary Carter, and again, it could just be that because of the current players that they or the people still alive that they interviewed, obviously there might not have been as much. I just felt like they could have integrated more of older interviews of him or just like more in general about yeah. him. I feel like they could have used more of him. And yeah, Jake and I think joked about this already, but it was interesting because before every episode they had a like explicit language warning, but the only player who needed that was Lenny Dykstra. It just needed a Lenny Dykstra exactly. warning, and like no one else really provided any explicit content except for Lenny Dykstra, where like everything he said needed to be bleeped out. So yeah.
that
was like
have been a shock to the ESPN producer.
No,
like, they had to have had this idea going in that every other word out of this guy's mouth was going to be an MF-er, because that's exactly what it turned out to be. And I loved it. Like, I can't say I didn't like
no,
it.
No, I was entertained, but
that was hilarious. And I loved his mentality, like that nobody was better than him, and like yes. he was that short guy. Now it kind of makes sense, like how he became the player he was with that nails mentality.
Yeah. It's like when he gets, they make a big deal about him getting up in that game and getting that hit that sort of like kicked things off and they all started hitting after that. That's the kind of thing that, along with a lot of other things actually in the documentary, I'm like, God, with today's analytics, none of this happens. Like none of these random decisions happen where like, let's put Lenny Dykstra up in this spot and like see what he does. And then he happens to, you know, crank out a hit. and just all the decisions in the NLDS, NLCS, and even in the World Series, almost all of like the big ones that were game changing things. I'm like, I just don't see a manager making those decisions today. And also obviously there's a lot of differences. There's the shift now and the way people play and what people know about opposing teams and stuff. But it just seemed like there were so many times that their manager was like, what if we try this? Like what if this would work? Even though it wasn't that any kind of knowledge brought them to that. It was just like, it was like almost like a feeling, like, let me put Lenny up in this spot. And it wasn't something that he would normally do. And I think that's also part of what's so cool about kind of old school baseball is that there's a little bit of that magic to it where now it feels like everything is a sabermetric. Everything is like numbers crunched and don't
feels more calculated.
Yes. And I love the movie Moneyball. Don't get me wrong. I think it's a good movie, but also I sometimes get a little sad thinking about how are like, you know, that they are making these decisions and they're not always right. Because at the end of the day, there's luck and there's injuries and there's just like getting that hit that you can't anticipate that person would get at that time. I mean, like we were just saying about that ridiculous game at the end of 2019, Adini Echevarria hit those two home runs. And we're like, we just traded this person and now he's on a team hitting home runs again.
Typical Mets story right there.
Yes. And it's like, you know, no scouting report is going to tell you that that's going to happen.
Yeah, that's what the game's missing now, and that's why I'm very happy the Mets have hired Buck Showalter, because I feel like he kind of provides that old school feel to the game, and it's not just where he's a puppet and he's going to make all of his decisions based on the numbers that the front office handed him before the game. And I feel like Davey Johnson was such a good manager in this. I mean, obviously this documentary brought light to many things, but it brought light to how great of a manager Davey was and how when they first brought him on, he said, like, this is going to be my team. Like, I'm going to run it the way I want and you're not going to get in the way of it. Otherwise, I'm not doing this. And they kind of just – they gave him the ropes, and we know, obviously, what the result was. But, yeah, I feel like the game really does miss that, like the Bruce Bochy's of the world, the real feel old-school managers that you can't make every decision based on a number. You kind of got to have some out-of-the-box thinking, which it doesn't seem there tends right to be much of that in the game today.
Yeah, analytics don't factor in revenge, which it seemed like was important in back in the day. But something else also I thought about too was how much I enjoyed hearing from Mookie Wilson, and he's always extremely entertaining. And like, why isn't he on TV more? Like, maybe it's his choice. Like, I don't know, but yeah. That was one of my big takeaways too. It was like, I feel like we need more of him just in the Mets universe in general, whether it's like just as an analyst in on SNY or just like in the booth sometimes. I don't know. I would love to hear more from him in a Mets related context because he's just extremely entertaining and like wonderful to listen to.
He's so funny. Like he just has this very chill vibe and I love everything that he had to say. And he just seemed so relaxed the whole documentary because there were certain points where you almost feel like Keith was relaxed for most of it, but certain times you could tell he's like a little bit emotional about, you know, when he went to court and that kind of stuff. And you can tell there's some resentment, anger issues there with what he went through back in St. Louis. But there was one part of it that stuck in my head where he's like, they definitely turned the heat up in that courthouse because I was sweating through my suit. And I'm like, I wonder if they did actually turn the heat up, or he's like convinced that they did this to mess with him.
I loved how they showed after that whole drug thing and after he went to court and his first game back playing at home, he got a standing ovation. And I feel like that just shows how much the fans, and it's great to see that at the time, like obviously we as Mets fans now, and I wasn't alive obviously, but we appreciate Keith and we always talk about Keith in this high regard, but it's nice to see that even back in the day before they won anything really, that they still thought of him as fondly as we do now.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, he said too, doesn't he say in the documentary that he was terrified of coming back? Like he thought that he'd be booed or,
yep.
And then one of the things that I feel like a lot of people, I wrote this down when I was watching it. There was a lot of people that said some version of, winning covers a lot of sins. Mm-hmm. And I think they were talking kind of in reference to the whole season of all the, you know, the all the different players' issues with drugs, which obviously was rampant in the league in general at that time. But yeah, and then the brawls on the road and getting arrested at a strip club, and you know,
a story that in
I forget if they talked about, they must have, with like Ron Darling, yeah, like punching a police officer or whatever it was in like Houston, that because he wrote about that in one of his book too, which I think is wild, especially when you like listen to him today, because he's like, I don't know, it's just funny, but
he's so like sedate on the air and
relatively mild mannered,
yes, and you're like, this guy punched, what, he punched a who?
It was a different time. It was a different time.
That's, and I remember someone telling, I met someone once who was somewhere out in the Midwest for a friend's wedding, and the Mets were on the road in the so I'm trying to think where he was. They must have been playing like the Brewers or something, because it was just like a super random, like they were out at a bar the night before the wedding, and one of them's like, hey, is that Ron Darling? Because most of them were from in town from New York for the wedding, and they're like, that's totally Ron Darling, like at the other end of the bar. So they approached him and were like, hey Ron, like, can we buy you a drink, we're from New York. And he ended up buying all of them, wow, drinks. Like he like put them all on his tab and was like, you guys have fun. Like have a great wedding tomorrow. And I'm like, and that totally sounds like what you'd expect.
What a gym.
Right? Like you'd expect him to be like that. But yeah, like you said, it was a different time. And the, you know, they were known as the bad guys won. They were known as sort of these lunatic baseball players. Yes. And also I need to know, did Kevin Mitchell actually kill a cat? Is that a joke? Is that real? Like, did he kill a cat? I can't tell. Like the way they talk about it, I'm like, would they joke about it so much?
There's a shroud of mystery over a lot of things.
Wouldn't have been the craziest thing that took place with them. So,
right. It's like he killed his girlfriend's cat and he's going, I love animals. I didn't kill it. And I think it's Daryl. He's like, oh no, he killed his girlfriend's cat. And I'm like, that's really not good if that's accurate.
Maybe that's why they thought he was a bad influence and traded him. I don't know.
I hope they traded him. They were pissed
because of that. They were all for animal rights, apparently, at the time. Mm-hmm. Or I guess.
They were cat lovers.
Yeah, exactly. I was also hoping, like, I guess they weren't on the team, but I was kind of hoping for maybe some sort of interview with, like, some combination of Gary Cohen and Howie Rose, just because A, they're obviously such prominent figures with the Mets today, but also they were like working in sports at the time in 1986, you know, like they were in the midst of like sports related careers. I think Gary started with the Mets on radio the following season in 1987. So I don't know what your guys' thoughts were on that. I was kind of hoping to like hear from them in some fashion throughout the documentary. And I was kind of surprised that they weren't interviewed at all. So I don't know, that kind of stuck out to me as a slight omission. Again, maybe like three of the Lenny Dykstra anecdotes could have been shelved in favor of like three Gary Cohen anecdotes. Again, just me. But that was kind of something I thought about, was like, again, they weren't really integral to the 86 Mets necessarily, but yeah, I think in retrospect, they could have been voices that would have been relevant to this documentary.
Yeah. No, I agree. I would have liked that. There were some surprising people in it, and then also people that I thought were surprising. Then you realize that they were kind of more interconnected. Like, I mean, I knew Billy Bean was, but I seeing Billy Bean talk was interesting. I thought a lot of stuff that he had to say was cool. I was very surprised. I didn't know George R.R. Martin was a Mets fan, because all of a sudden George R. Martin is there.
Like, yeah, I was like, what?
I was like, oh, okay. I didn't, yeah. And, you know, because I know in these type of documentaries they have, I love that Cyndi Lauper is a Mets fan. I didn't know that she was either. So that was cool. But yeah, I mean, I guess with something with this much like mythology behind it, I think there's always, when it's over, you're like, oh, there's so much that they could have also done instead. And I'm sure there's tons of stuff that ended up on the cutting room floor too, that, you know, we don't know about, that maybe is some of the stuff that we wish we could have, maybe there was more Mookie, or, you know, whoever knows. But yeah, it was good, because I remember there was a lot of people tweeting when it came out being like, oh, I don't want to watch anything that glorifies the 86 Mets anymore. Like, I'm tired of it. Like, it's embarrassing that they haven't done anything since then, et cetera, et cetera. And I mean, I understand that if that's how you feel about it, but I always wanted to watch it because there's only so much that I do know about it. And oh, the 30 for 30s are always so good and in depth and interesting, even when it's on something that I wouldn't think I would care about. So for this, I definitely wanted to watch. And I don't think it glorified them. I think it explained why they were glorified. That was what I got watching it, you know? I think that it explained like every step, like the two seasons prior, like what was happening, changes that were in the works and how it brought them to that season. And because also I didn't know that much about 85 and 84 leading into, and the moves that were being made then that led to them having that 86 team. And then I do sort of wish I knew a little bit more about George Foster, since he didn't want to participate in the doc. But also that's interesting too, because he was a huge star and they gave him the big contract, and then he came and he just had a rough time in New York. And when I was watching that part of it, even though they didn't have him talking, I was thinking, I'm like, wow, was that the first time that the Mets paid a lot of money for a big star and like didn't quite get what they paid for when he arrived? Because like we were saying, Jake, you were saying it before, we've seen this a lot in the history of the team. We would get so excited for someone who was amazing on another team and then comes to New York and is like, you know.
Yeah, I'm just going to forget how to play baseball.
Yeah, like batting 210 and like missing plays in the field, and, you know, breaking a thumb or, you know, some sort of.
Jason Bay running head first into the wall. I mean, he wasn't that good to begin with before the concussion. But yeah, you're 100%. You're 100%.
He was great before he came to the Mets, though. He was like
amazing. He was great. And they even, oh my God, we're going to go down a whole wormhole here. Yes. It's not going to be good.
Jason not, Bay gave us all trust issues.
Oh my God. Oh, you have no idea. Oh, you do have an idea. But
we do.
I guess we all have an idea. But yeah, I mean, I obviously know who George Foster is and know a little about his career, but it definitely showed me a lot more about him, and it sucks. I mean, I guess he wasn't shown in the best light in the doc because he wasn't a great Met. And I remember they showed in his first press conference, he's saying that they better make sure the planes don't fly too low because I'm going to be hitting them. Yeah, okay. He didn't hit much of anything. But yeah, it sucks.
He just didn't mesh with the rest of the team, it seemed like.
No, he didn't. It seemed like he had a completely different personality, but it sucked. Yeah, he wasn't in it. I mean, for his sake, I mean, it would have been nice for him to kind of be able to tell his side of the story, because now we only kind of have one side. But like you were saying, yeah, with the doc, for the people that are saying they didn't want to watch it because they're tired of hearing about the 86 Mets, well, this wasn't really, like you said, it wasn't just about them winning the World Series. In the beginning, they show the whole history of the team. They show all kinds of things that really honestly have nothing to do with the 86 Mets, just that kind of led up to that point. And with the 86 Mets itself, I mean, we learned so many more facts and so many more behind-the-scenes stories that I feel like a lot of us had never heard before. So I don't think that you could really compare this piece of work to others that have come out about this team, because there's just so much more insight that was provided and so many more angles they took to kind of talk about what led to the team and kind of the downfall of the team as well. It wasn't just, like you said, they weren't just being glorified. They presented all the facts about the drugs, about Keith's problems, about people they signed that didn't work out, and then how it all ended not so ceremoniously. So I just think I think it was great. And obviously there's things to nitpick, and I wish Howie Rosen, that's a great point, Elizabeth. I didn't even think about that, but I after watching it, I was very happy with kind of how it all came out.
Yeah, one thing I think is interesting too, it's like, I understand and I kind of agreed in the sense like that's, you know, yes, we keep like trotting out these anniversaries every season, and it would be nice to have, you know, a new championship team eventually to immortalize. But in some ways, like, I feel like also a lot of fans, at least maybe of like Jake and I's generation, almost feel like live vicariously through the 86 Mets team. And in a way, like, I think watching this documentary, we could almost like pretend that they were our team in a way, because like, that's kind of the most recent thing that we have. And so in some ways, yes, they weren't like our team and they were around before we were born, but like, at least the Mets have this, you know. Not every team, there's some teams that have never won a World Series. There's some teams that have, you know, I don't want to like make it like, oh, people have it worse than we do, but at least in a way, like, it's kind of cool that they even have this team that's been this, you know, mythologized in a way to reflect on. And yes, there's been a lot of discussion about it and books written about them over the years, and a lot of, you know, continuing to celebrate the 86 championship and those players being like hired to work on SNY, and which is great because now we have, you know, Keith and Ron in the booth, which is awesome, which we wouldn't have had without their championship probably, or possibly. But I also think it's like not every fan base even has a team like this cool to like reflect on. And so it's not the present day. It's not the Mets winning the World Series this year, but it's kind of cool to kind of live vicariously through it and be like, well, look, at least they have, you know, 86 and 69 to like reflect on as fans. I can't say I have a championship hangover from that season because I wasn't around. So I can't really like revisit that glory because I wasn't around for it. But it is kind of, I don't know, not every fan, not every baseball team has a team that could like provide material for this type of documentary. And it doesn't lead to like, doesn't mean that they're better or worse, but I just think it's kind of cool that at least they like have this to continue to unpack for decades to come, I suppose. Yeah. As opposed to not having any championships in their history that would be worthy of such a subject. So it was like, well, hey, it's still cool that this is a thing that we can keep being interested in, even if they haven't replicated it for over 30 years.
Yes. There's one of my other quotes that I really liked from the doc. I think Howard Bryant said it. He said, when you play in New York, the expectation is not just victory, but victory with style. And the 86 Mets understood that. And that, to me, I think that's still true today. I think that, you know, there's so much expectation of all New York sports teams. I have friends in other states who, you know, I have a friend in California and she's a big basketball person and she loves the Clippers. But she's still always checking on like what the Knicks and Nets are doing. And I asked her once and she's just like, I don't know. She was like, New York teams are always kind of exciting to check in on regardless. And I think about that too, because that is true, because I mean, the Yankees are universally hated by all the other teams. No other fans of any other team likes them as their secondary team. I feel like everyone has a secondary team, but no one's secondary team is the Yankees.
Every sport has that team.
No, it's like, I saw a really funny tweet. I forget what it was. Like, oh my God. Or maybe it was something related to like someone prominent being eliminated. Like, don't worry, Yankees baseball is just around the corner, or like whatever. Maybe it had to do with football. Like, I forget what it was.
When the Patriots lost last week, I saw a bunch of...
Yeah, it was like when the Patriots lost, I was like, oh, don't worry, Patriots fans. Yankees baseball is just around the corner. Like, I hear Duke basketball is doing well. Like, what about the Lakers? Let's check in on them. Yeah. So every sport has that one team that's like, yeah, you either are a fan or you hate them. And
yes, that's it.
I would love, though, like how in the 80s the Mets were hated by every other fan base. I would so embrace that. Like, if everyone hated us, I would love that. I'm tired of being the lovable. Yeah. Like, that would mean we're good. If people hate us, that would be a really good
sign. Like, nobody boos
bad. Like, when the visiting team comes, like, their lineup gets announced, nobody boos players who suck. Like, no. You know what I mean? Yeah. Unless you're, like, Paul DeJong and you're only good against the Mets and, like, bad against everyone else. So maybe that's, like...
Hey, Andrew Stevenson. Don't forget.
Andrew Stevenson. Yes. Disaster.
God, I definitely lost my voice on numerous occasions booing Chase Utley.
Oh, I've never hated, like, not even, like, this is going to sound horrible, but I've never hated a human in my life more than I hate Chase Utley. Like, not even an athlete. Like, he's just such, like, I hate the, I have nothing nice to say about that man.
Nothing.
Not even like that. I'm just pissed that he was good. Like, he was really good. Like, I'm not going to lie. But he's a scumbag, and I just don't like him. For being a
bird here, not first, but once again,
I've said it multiple times.
Yeah,
continue.
But yeah, no, it's interesting. I would also like to hear. It'd be interesting. I don't know if this would have had space in the documentary, but to hear from like other like player, like more also from like other players in other teams from that season about like what they thought of the Mets or like what it was like playing them. Maybe that would have been interesting. Again, I don't know if that would have had as much of a place given that this was already four parts long, but yeah. it would also be interesting to hear some more like firsthand knowledge of like players and fans or even like other front office executives around that time, kind of like what they thought of the Mets that season, like what they felt like when they were, you know, taking the field against them, just to kind of get it even more perspective. Cause we kind of know in general, yeah, they like started a lot of fights, played a little dirty. Like it wasn't, you know, they definitely were not liked by other teams. But you're right, like Jake was saying, people don't like choose to hate teams that are bad, like right. generally. You know, there has to be some reason you don't yeah. like them. Like, I don't generally root against players that like aren't good. Like, I have to have a reason to dislike them. Like, I pity root for teams, but I don't pity root for good teams. Like, you know, right. so.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I mean, like, I do kind of, like we were talking about before, hate the Marlins because they screwed us so many times. But it's also, it's not like a true hatred because they're not good enough to hate. They're more like a pebble in your shoe.
The pest, kind of yeah.
hate. Yes. But yes, no, you're right. No one hates the team that's, you know, playing below 500.
Which is why no one ever hates us.
Yeah, exactly. I would
love to be more slightly, yeah. Or even like, yeah, exactly. But
yeah. Actually, yeah, Elizabeth, you're right. That would have been interesting to hear what other players thought. Because didn't they have, I thought they had one quick thing, but not about the 86 Mets. Didn't they have one quote about, I think, the 69 Mets, where someone, like one of the players on the Yankees was like, no matter where I hit the ball, they always seem to be there waiting for it. Or maybe I'm making that up. Or I read that somewhere else. I feel like I heard
I saw,
that.
No, I saw that somewhere too. I don't know if that was in the
doc.
I know exactly
maybe that was in the doc. But I feel like it was like Mickey Mantle or something was, every time I hit the ball, like, this asshole's right there to catch yeah. it. You know, something like that. I'm paraphrasing, obviously.
Or like, I even would have wanted to hear more, like, some from Mike Scott, how they were talking about how he was scuffing the balls.
Yeah,
and like,
I didn't know
all of that either.
Like, I'd like to hear more of like the Astro side of the story about that, you know, but yes. I mean, that would have been really interesting. But yeah, I didn't realize that. Like, I knew how good of a pitcher Mike Scott
was. I didn't know the extent of like the whole scuffing situation.
But I didn't understand the whole scuffing thing. Like, I didn't know that was such a big deal until they really
brought that he definitely was doing it, you know.
Yeah.
It was like a really like in-depth search they were trying to put this guy through. I didn't realize all that.
I had no idea. And then also, yeah, to the fact that they were saying, look at his record from last season. Now all of a sudden he's an amazing pitcher. Like that doesn't happen from one season to the next. And I mean, it can. I mean, Jacob DeGrom. Let's bring up Jacob DeGrom.
Yes, let's go.
I mean, he gets better and better every season. But also, he started out
true. If you look from 2017
to 2018, the only thing that really changed was his hair, and then his ERA went down 2 runs. So I guess it worked. Almost 2 runs. It's remarkable.
Yes. Just had to lose some hair. Come on, Noah Syndergaard. You should
actually. You know what? No, don't cut your hair.
Let him keep those long.
Now that you're in LA, leave it long and get fit right in.
Let him get shelled up.
It'll fit right in with all the surfer people in Los Angeles.
What do you think he does after this season, though? You think he'll go somewhere else?
I think he's gonna have a big. I think he's gonna have a really good year. And I'm just kidding. Like, I really am rooting for the guy because.
I know. Me too. It's like
guy, like the way he left. I mean, it sucks. Saves to say whatever. But he had that nice video, whatever. And I know
it's not the worst way it could have happened. No. I feel like at the time I was like, oh my god, and now I'm like, actually, he just chose to sign with the Angels.
But the Angels should keep him because if he has a good year, the Angels need pitching more than anyone else. They've been wasting Trout's career forever. I mean, they need pitching. So with him and Otani at the top of the rotation, if Syndergaard has a good year, I don't know why they would let him leave.
Right. Yeah, that'll be interesting.
But I'd be shocked if he didn't have a good year. Yeah. He's too good of a pitcher.
I hope he does, because I hope that we haven't seen, like, the last of him being amazing.
Harvey, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
At least Matt Harvey was, like, let's be honest, he was a dick on his way out. Like, he wasn't the easiest, you know, like he wasn't showing up. He was whatever. Syndergaard kind of did it with grace. Like, he was never a problem. Everyone loved him. So I don't want that to happen. Not that we wanted it to happen to Harvey, but I don't want the same thing. You know what I mean? Where he peaked so early in his career. Like, I think he just has so much talent.
I hope he comes back strong.
After Tommy John, I mean, he's gone, what, 2 appearances since then. I hope for his sake that, yeah, he has a good year. But one thing also, just going back to the NLCS against the Astros, like, I didn't realize that Roger McDowell pitched five scoreless innings in game 6. I had literally no clue. I was like, shout out to that. I feel like that particular performance doesn't get talked about a lot because, like, that was extremely clutch. So, and I, like, didn't even know that happened. Mm-hmm. So
I also didn't know, because I've always just, like, known of, like, Ron as being an important part of the team. And my dad was the one who told me, actually, a while back before the documentary. He's like, yeah, Ron didn't pitch that well in the World Series.
Well, that's his whole book, Game 7, 1986, is about, which is an interesting read, because about how he – well, because Game 6 happened, and then he knew he was starting the next game. Then it was rained out, So we had the whole day to like think about it. And then, yeah, he gave up whatever his line was, like three runs and like three and a third innings. And then like Sid Fernandez came in after that. But yeah, it's interesting because he was obviously happy they won the World Series, but the competitive nature in him didn't really allow him to like experience the full joy of having pitched his team to the title, which he didn't really do. He kind of had to get bailed out. Right. So it is interesting from his perspective. That book talks a lot about it, which is definitely a good read, but
yeah, I think about stuff like that all the time, how like Acuna had to sit out the World Series this year while his team won. Like his shoestring team came back from the dead in July and somehow won the World Series. And
all of their outfielders just overperformed.
And he had to sit on the bench. And in a normal year, he would have led that team, you know, like in every game. But that's sort of a, you know, so you get the ring, but he didn't really play, and you know, that's rough.
That sucks. It's like, it reminds me, and obviously completely different sport, but a few years ago when the Eagles won the Super Bowl, Carson Wentz kind of led them all year, and then he got hurt like with 2 weeks left, and then he had to watch Nick Foles take them all the way, and just while he sat there and watched basically what was his team now be led by somebody else. I feel like it's got to be it's a great feeling you won, but it's got to be a helpless feeling at the same time. Like, I've been here running this the whole time, and now I can't do anything.
Probably when someone pictures winning the Super Bowl, that's not how they picture it. No. Like, so in some ways it's great that it happened. I'm sure he was like overjoyed, but that's still, it's like, wait, it happened, but like, this is nothing like what I thought. I didn't think that I'd be injured as the quarterback and someone else would do it for the, So that's a good comparison.
The Braves were even able to win this year. I know they obviously got all those pieces at the deadline, but to be missing a superstar, a top 10 player in the sport like Ronald Acuna, and to still win the World Series is an amazing feat all on its own. I mean, obviously it's so hard to win one anyway, but without your best player, if they were going in the year and you were going to tell them halfway through the year you're going to lose Ronald Acuna, I bet Braves fans probably thought they'd have no chance.
Coming back. Yeah.
So, I mean, that's just – it's, and I wasn't that upset. I mean, if the Phillies won the World Series, I'd want to shoot myself. But the Braves the Braves and the Nationals, I could deal with. Like, I could deal with that. It's fine because they haven't – you know, like, it's not like we've really been good at the same time over the last, 15 years. So,
Yeah,
it's incredible. Yeah.
The Phillies I would have been really upset about because – same as you, just because we were so right at the same kind of level as them for so long during the season, and then when they passed us in the standings, I was so angry that
Zach Wheeler pitched that like three hit shutout.
The Mets did nothing, and I was like, good for Zach Wheeler. Like, you know what, he deserves this. Like,
I kept thinking, I'm like, if the Phillies get in, I'll be so angry because it just proves that we so easily could have just like waltzed in the door into the postseason and somehow still didn't make it. So it made me feel slightly better.
Because the Braves didn't even
win 90 games, did they? Didn't they win like 88, 89?
They definitely did not win 90 games because they were terrible for like the first half of the season. And then all of a sudden they weren't terrible, like right at the halfway mark. And then they, like Jake said, made moves at the deadline, which we did not do. And it was,
they could smell that we were dead in the water.
And I also could.
I like tried not to be super negative about it, but like, I really, like, we've talked about this, honestly, after that Pirates series, I felt like I was over. And, like, I know, I really felt that at the time. I'm not just saying this in retrospect, I swear.
And once the Grom didn't come back after the All-Star.
Yeah, and then I was like, no.
We weren't going anywhere without the Grom, so, I mean.
No.
This year will be different. We are still delusional. But something else I was wondering, Danielle. So, we haven't talked about this a ton yet, but you've been involved in a lot of different aspects of the like film and TV industry throughout your career so far, which, you know, we could have a whole another episode about like all the cool things that you've done as well, which I'd love to hear more about in the future. But I'm curious from like your perspective, kind of working in those fields in a lot of different roles, is there anything kind of from that like production aspect or even like writing or structural aspect for the documentary that like you would have done differently if, say, you were involved in producing it?
More Mookie.
There we go.
More Mookie. But no, I thought it was really, really well done. It was such a good combination for me personally, as a lot of stuff you already know with a little bit of, what you didn't know about the thing you do know. And then also brand new information, like talking about the scuffing of the ball with the series with the Astros, and which I knew nothing about. That, and also I knew a little bit about that very famous, or shall we say, infamous plane ride back to New York. And I don't think I knew exactly though about what happens when they got back and they're told like that they're gonna have to pay for it, and Davey and the rest of them are like, we're not fucking paying for shit. Like, and they're just like, get out there and play. And, you know, and they got out there and played. And then they all of them having the different, I think it was X amount of dollars of damage. I think it was this amount of dollars of damage. And the fact that they all didn't quite know, and it just kept getting higher and like more astronomical. I thought that was so funny. And you know, obviously it's not great to trash an airplane, of course. And I hope they were nice to the flight attendants in the course of trashing the plane. But also, you know, I try to think of it in that context. We're talking about, you know, a lot of guys who are doing a lot of cocaine and also just having done something that they never thought that they would do. I try to take that into account. And as long as maybe Kevin Mitchell didn't actually kill a cat in the course of all of this.
That's the only thing we care about, honestly.
That's all Danielle took.
I don't care what else happened.
Did Kevin Mitchell kill that damn cat or not?
I need to know, because I thought Kevin Mitchell was really funny in the doc. I thought the pacing of it was really good, because that's the thing with documentaries. Sometimes, you know, when you get you can get bogged down in details and things can feel slow. I never felt, and granted, obviously, like we all are, we're a little bit of a biased audience, if you will, but I never felt bored. I never felt like I wanted to fast forward through anything. I was just, everything that happened, I was either nodding like, oh yeah, I knew that, or oh cool, I didn't know that, or oh shit, you know? And I thought it was really well put together, especially, you know, in the beginning where they bring in what's going on in New York in the 80s and what's happening, you know, on Wall Street and what's happening with the economy and just people who were living in New York at the time. And it almost, I felt like they're sort of setting the stage, like New Yorkers wanted something. They wanted something exciting to happen. They wanted something good for the city. And, you know, it came from this unexpected place, came from these crazy guys who were, you know, like you said, not super well liked in the league at the time, because they were a little crass, a little rough. And, but they got the job done. They went to the show. So I think probably just the things I mentioned earlier, just I wish I could have seen some of what George Foster had to say, but obviously if he wasn't willing to talk, there's nothing could do about that. You know, a little more Mookie, because he seems to have he seems to have just like a cool, like funny spin on things. Yeah, and I mean, I'll always take more Doc, just because Doc has such a, I want to say this in the right way, he has like almost like a gentleness about him when he talks about, you just want to go like hang out with him and listen to baseball stories and maybe throw the ball around. But yeah, no, I think it was super well done, and you know, kind of, now that we're talking about it, I kind of want to watch it again.
Yeah, same. I have it still recorded, so I could easily do that. Yeah, I don't know. I think like the things I mentioned, I almost thought there was maybe a little, I felt like some of the cultural context they provided might have been a little of a stretch. I don't know if you guys agreed. Like, I feel like they were trying to connect a lot of dots with like what the Mets were doing with all this other stuff happening. I don't necessarily know if I needed all of that, but like some of those, I forget exactly what some of those comparisons they made. I thought some of that might've been a little bit of a stretch, but again, I also like wasn't there. So, and I'm not a historian expert on the time. So that's kind of was just my general instinct feeling that way. But aside from that, I definitely agree with everything you said about like things that could have slightly been tweaked. But yeah, I don't think like any major things were really left out that like fans know about. And we're like, I can't believe they didn't dive into this topic. I didn't really get any of that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. There wasn't anything that I except for George Foster. I don't think there was anything that I was left. Why didn't they talk about such and such? And I think that I didn't know as much about the ownership change, like the changeover of ownerships and how exactly it all, I think, because I think that's something I only really started paying attention to when I was probably in high school. And that was just shortly before the terrible Wilpon era began, and which we all know was a terrible, terrible blight on humanity.
Nightmare. Best way to put it is a nightmare.
That's an insult to blights, frankly. But
it's an insult to blights. It's an insult to David Wright is what it is.
Yes. Oh my God. Jake and I talked about his book a while back, but honestly, I don't know. Have you read The Captain?
I haven't read it yet.
Really good. It's really good.
Definitely recommend. It's part of it, I'll be honest, is like a little sad and like hard to read It's like, oh my, like just I,
and
he
you
talks
know,
a
like,
lot.
You know what's going to come. Like at the end of the book, like you know how it's going to end. Which
just
like,
all of his rehab from his back injuries. Like I really, as a fan at the time, had like no idea like how strenuous. I don't want to spoil it, but he talks a lot about that. And so you get a lot of detail into like his rehab process and just how motivated he was to make it back to the field. It's like truly remarkable in retrospect that he even made it back. So
there was an interview he gave back, I'm trying to remember now. It was right before he was like kind of done, but like we didn't know that yet. And it was one of the seasons he was like in and out, and I'm blanking on which one it was, but I remember he did an interview and he said, which I'm sure he probably goes into more detail in the book about this, but he was saying that he was heading to the field 2 hours before everybody else to do his stretches just to be able to do the team stretches and like the team warm-ups and workouts, because like if he didn't come 2 hours early to stretch himself out and warm up, he wouldn't be able to do what they were doing. And I was like, that's insane. That's 4 hours of, you know, getting warmed up before a game, like before he even plays. And then he was still, you know, like hitting bombs and making great plays and was probably just in so much pain the whole time he was doing it. And it kills me. Well, like you just said,
just brace y'all. Yeah, it's not like gory, but it's definitely some of it's like
it's
a little
sad. Like you said, like as Mets fans, we don't really have that fairy tale ending. We don't have the Derek Jeter where he got to play out his. I get Derek Jeter's an anomaly for any franchise, but like where he got to play out his career, and even though they didn't go to the playoffs his last year, he had that walk off hit. Like he ended in this great way. Like our great way for David Wright was getting him out there for four innings.
There's no player that's had a fairy tale, right? Not even close.
13 innings just so Austin Jackson could hit a walk-off double against the Marlins in a meaningless game. Like that's our fairy tale ending for David Wright, which sucks because that guy did everything, and like it sucks to like irony, but he did everything the right way. Like everything. Like there was never a time where he said something wrong off the field. Like he was just such a great leader for the team on and off the field. And we've talked about this a lot, but it sucks how it had to end for him.
Yeah. I mean, that's why other players on other teams loved him too. When we swept the NLDS, was it the NLDS? No, was it CS against
in 2015.
The Cubs.
Yeah.
Yes. Against the Cubs, which made my Cubs loving cousin very angry at me.
They got 2016 like, though.
So
I had read that they gave David they gave him third base from the final game as like a congrats, good luck in the World Series kind of thing. And I mean, that's a huge thing. The Cubs had come that far and just to be completely, I mean, we destroyed them in that series.
I felt so good.
Oh my God. That whole series, I was like, I can't believe this. They're like, they beat Jake Arrieta. He was the Cy Young. Like, I don't know. I've never felt more cocky as a fan to be than that series. Like, I'll be honest.
I went into that series just like having, I'm like, I know we're going to win this. I didn't think we were going to sweep it. I was like, we're definitely going to win this, but I'm glad it was an easy one because it was like that momentum was good. Like going into the final, it was just,
and not for nothing, that series against the Dodgers was so stressful. So to have a non-stressful series as a kind of a break was nice. Yes.
I was not expecting that at all, that like four-game masterclass. I was like,
Daniel Murphy was unconscious. He was hitting home runs left and right.
I know. Remember? Like it was like he woke up one day and just decided to be really good.
Like if only it were that easy. Yeah.
He got even better.
Yeah,
right. Another typical Mets story. Either we bring them here and they suck, or we let them go and they're great. There's no in between.
That's absolutely what happens every time.
But speaking of David Wright, so I know we're running out of time, but so Keith's getting his jersey retired this summer. And in my opinion, the next person I would love to see get their jersey retired, and I know he's never going to go to the Hall of Fame, but I would love for the Mets to retire David Wright's jersey sooner rather than later. I think it's a foregone conclusion. It's going to happen. He leads them in almost every hitting statistic. Like, he's an all-time Met. So I think it's going to happen. But me personally, that's who I would like to see them retire next. I'd like to hear both of your opinions on who you'd like to see get their jersey retired in the near future.
Well, I'm a diehard David Wright person. So yes, I'm fully on board with David being next, because, you know, I think if he had retired differently, then obviously I would wait. But I think, like you said, he's not going to get to the Hall of Fame. However, if he had had a fully healthy career, I think he probably would have had a pretty good shot.
He would have gotten votes, at least.
He would have gotten votes, yes. And also he's a Hall of Famer to us, you know, and that's what retiring the jersey means in my head. You know, it's like, that's our Hall of Fame guy. And that's David. And if for more from the 86 team, yeah, Gary Carter, definitely, I think, should be up there.
I think Keith also, not just because of what he did as a player, but also since he's so prominent as an announcer for the last like 15 years, I think that makes, you know, not that he wouldn't have earned it as a player in his own right, but I also think having the announcing career that he's become even more, you know, so beloved to a generation that never saw him play, I think that also factored into in him getting his number retired. I also agree, and I think retiring David Wright's number in the next like couple of years, I actually think it like is fairly likely to happen. I don't know, just because I think it would set a new precedent of there's no need to wait 30 years to retire David Wright's number. We know today that he is a franchise icon and deserves it. Like, the Giants retired Eli Manning's number, like, right, this year.
Right.
Yeah, obviously. Like, yeah. Why wait 10 more years? He, like,
does, yeah.
Or the Rangers with, like, Henrik Lundqvist, same thing. Like, there's no reason for these obvious franchise icons that are still around. Like, just, why not just retire their number, like, now? You know, personally, I think that would set a good precedent of not waiting forever,
right,
for no reason to retire his number. So I hope they do it. And like, I think honestly it has a decent chance of being maybe like 2023. I don't see why not after, yeah, Keith's number.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's the thing, like we're saying about Steve Cohen, he seems to have a completely different way of making decisions and running things over there, and I think he probably would be inclined to agree, because the Wilpons botched the Tom Seaver dedication for how long, you know?
There should have been a statue, like
when Citi Field opened. I mean, it's just embarrassing.
It's embarrassing. And Steve Cohen is a fan. The Wilpons were, they did never seemed like fans, not even just fans of the Mets, but just fans of baseball. And Steve Cohen is not only a fan of baseball, but has been a very big Mets fan for a long time. So he knows how we feel, because he's, in a way, I mean, he'll never be one of us. He's a bajillionaire, but you know, in some ways he has a little bit of us.
Oh, he does, a lot of us, I think. Yeah, I agree with you, because Fred Wilpon grew up a Brooklyn Dodgers fan, and I love Jackie Robinson, but that's why that whole Jackie Robinson rotunda is in Citi Field. That's why Citi Field is shaped like
Ebbets Field.
Because Fred Wilpon grew up a Brooklyn Dodger fan. It's nice that Steve Cohen grew up a Mets fan, and he has the feel for the fan base. Like, he understands what we want, and that's why, like you said, Elizabeth, why wait to retire David Wright's jersey?
It would set a good precedent, I think, to just recognize, again, you know, there's, if they waited like five more years, it would also be, it'd be fine. But I just think it would set a good precedent to be like, yeah, obviously David Wright's going to get his number retired. Yeah, let's just do it next year. You know what I mean? There's no reason
and
to wait.
He touched this, this generation of fans.
Yeah.
In 10, 15 years, the younger fans are going to have no idea basically what David Wright meant to this fan base or to this team. Like, we know he just got done playing. Like, we still have that feeling of 2015 was the last time we really had any success, and he was a huge part of that. Like, why wait? Like, we know what he means to us. It's going to mean less. Maybe it's wrong to say it'll mean less in 10, 15 years, but like, it won't have nearly the same feeling, I feel like, that if they did it now.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's the least we can do. We couldn't get David his ring, but you know, he got to hit home runs in the World Series, and you know, he got to be the captain of our team, and it's very deserving. And yeah, waiting 10 years isn't going to change it in any way. So you might as well.
It's not, there's no like required, it's not like for when, for being eligible for the Hall of Fame, you have to be retired for 5 years. Like there's nothing in any book that says you have to be retired for 5 years to get your number retired. That is not a rule as far as I know. So that would be nice. But yeah, aside from him, like it's kind of sad. It's like, obviously the Mets haven't had that many long, like there's not that many players that have spent years with the Mets that like warrant number retirement in their history. There's like David Wright. You could certainly make arguments for like Gary Carter, and that's the thing too. Keith's the first player from this 86 team. Yes. And so far the only to have their number retired, even though they as a team are so, you know, glorified. And I think Carter, like that might happen. I don't know if it will. And no, they don't really give his number out though, do they? So
no,
that's,
they don't.
Yeah. Like who wears number 8? I that's a sign that I think it like might happen, but I also don't know that that's related. So
that's the thing too, if you're not giving it out, what, retire it?
Like, yeah, or like
you've done that with Paul O'Neill's jersey for how long, you know what I mean? Like teams do that a lot. Like if you're not going to hand it out, what's the point of, why don't you honor the person and retire the jersey if you're not going to hand it out anyway? Like what's the point?
Right.
Yeah,
because I'm trying to think, like, would they retire Doc Gooden's jersey? Like I don't think they will. I don't know. I don't think they would. Maybe, but I don't know if I see that happening. Or like Strawberry, like I'm just not sure, honestly, that there's that many other numbers that they're going to retire in the near future.
Right. Yeah.
We'll see.
We'll just celebrate whenever David Wright gets his number retired, which will happen. We'll just be extra happy about that. We'll have like 3 different ceremonies for it. It'll be great.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, we know he can give a good speech because he gave his at that game, because I was at that game, and you know, the game's dragging on into whatever inning it was. And so someone next to us starts yelling. He's like, just end it. We just want to hear David talk. And I couldn't stop laughing. And I was saying, because I had brought my dad, and I said, oh, I really, I feel this is David's, I'm the luckiest man, Lou Gehrig's, I feel like the luckiest man speech. And I'm so afraid that I'm going to cry when he starts talking.
If I had been there, I wasn't there, but I cried watching the video on YouTube.
I was there and it felt like going to a funeral. That's what I always tell people it felt like. Like you knew what you were there for, and it just wasn't, it was nice to see him, but it was just a very sad feeling.
It was the only happy moment I had is when he came out. Well, two moments. When he first came out, they let him run out by himself, and he, you know, when he kicked third base like he always used to do, and everybody was just balls to the wall screaming.
Yeah.
And I don't think I had felt that kind of energy in there since 2015, and you know, and he looked so happy. And then when the game was over, because everybody, like by the end of the game, the energy in the stadium was like you said, very
yeah.
Time's a ticking.
Get this shit over with.
Yeah,
shit over with. And so then it ended, and we're all just, you know, kind of sitting there for a minute, and then they announced for David to come back out, and all of a sudden it was like everyone just woke up again, and everyone was screaming, and you know, and he's clearly crying and giving his speech. And when he walked off the field and he did his, you know, his hat up in the air, and it was like this mixture of like just screaming, yelling, crying all around you. And you're like, oh my God, it's so weird to be here because it feels history making, but also it's so sad.
Yeah.
One thing I thought that was interesting that he mentioned in his book, and again, not to totally segue into, although, you know, why not? We love David Wright. But one thing I thought was interesting in his book that he mentioned when he was trying to figure out what game, and then, not to spoil this for you, it's not like a huge deal.
Oh, it's okay.
But when he was trying to figure out like what game to come back for, he specifically said that he did not want to have his final game be during one of DeGrom's starts, because he knew that DeGrom was like in the middle of a Cy Young season, and he did not want to like be a liability. Say he like, you know, didn't get to a ball and it like got through for a hit. He didn't want to contribute to him like giving up any runs that could potentially impact his Cy Young campaign. So he specifically, I forget, this is like near the end of the book, but he said, he's like, I didn't want to, you know, come back during a DeGrom start because I didn't want to mess anything up for him. And I was like, oh, wow, oh my God, like I thought that was like so thoughtful. I forgot who did start that game for the Mets. Like I don't actually remember.
I think it was Steven Matz.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds right. But yeah, no, he mentioned in the book that he's like,
because I thought that was weird. I feel like Noah pitched the next day for some reason.
He did. He threw a complete game shutout.
Oh, to end the season. That's right.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Because I was at that. I was that. Those were like 2 years in a row that I went to like the last few games.
Those are two good games.
Yes. Even, I had a couple good years.
There
then,
we go.
You know, to make up for 2020 where we didn't get to go to any games. And then 2021 where we got to go to some games, sort of.
And yeah. We tried. Runs were scored in the making of this baseball season. Unfortunately, they weren't allowed.
Tagline.
Yeah, exactly. That's my slogan for Mets in 2021. I'll be trademarking that after this episode.
You should. That's good.
That's really good.
Thank you. I'll make my own hat or something. Mets 2021 Mets.
Ooh. No runs were scored in the making of this season.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a good t-shirt.
Yeah, you should make that. You can make a t-shirt.
But like, do I want to remember that though? Yeah. Like,
no, I guess not. Well, hopefully we could like have so much success this year that we can just laugh.
I'll be like, that'll be, oh, haha. Remember when they couldn't score runs? That was so funny. Like, while I'm like, yeah, exactly. Yes. That's so
funny. Let's get new baseballs this year, not dead baseballs. And start.
Yes, let's not restart the dead ball era, please. No desire for that. Nope.
Well, Danielle, we can't thank you enough for coming on, spending all this time with us. This was so much fun.
My pleasure.
Covered a lot of ground.
Oh, so fun. So yeah, but if you could let our listeners know where they could find you on social media so they could interact with you as well, that'd be great.
Anything you want to plug too, let us know.
Okay. I'm on Twitter most of the time, unfortunately, at Elsep, ELLESEP, where I talk a lot about Mets baseball. And I've dabbled a little bit into football in the last few weeks just because I've been
said, and I quote, football is fun sometimes yesterday, which I agree. That was a fun game. But
yeah, the games this weekend are really fun.
Amazing, amazing.
Yeah, game. I'm not really a big football person, but I do watch the playoffs every year because that always feels like there's something for me to root for because I think, oh, they're so close to the end now, I can just pick someone to get excited about.
Yeah.
Like a total fake football fan.
Yeah, like, oh, manufacturing rooting interest every year because my team's never rooted. Let's go.
Yeah, it's like, well, like yesterday I thought the Bills seemed like a really interesting team this season, and I like their guy Josh Allen. Then I was
he was so, that whole game was crazy. I've never seen two quarterbacks play as well in the same game ever. Yeah. And I like might have missed some games over the years, but that was my perspective.
Totally. But then also part of me is like, well, I'd love for Mahomes to get another shot at the Super Bowl because, you know, Tom Brady's out of it. So maybe our former Mets pitcher son can bring us.
I know the Mets always post about it, which is nice. Or actually this year they were like, okay, guys, like, who are you rooting for? Pat Mahomes' son or the squad upstate or something like that?
Yes, I saw that. And so, you know, it's actually somebody wrote under, and I'm surprised it wasn't you that wrote it. Someone wrote, tell us who DeGrom is rooting for in that to wear.
Honestly, yeah. Honestly, I root for teams if I know, like, famous people I admire, root for them. I'll be honest, that does factor into my manufacture of rooting interests every year.
Yes, that's true. I used to work with Christine Baranski, and she's a Buffalo Bills fan. So I was like, you know what? I'm
there. We go.
Bills for Christine.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, they didn't pull it out for her.
Yeah. Well, we had Maggie Gray on our podcast last year, who used to work at WFAN, and she's a big Bills fan. So I was like, oh, and then she was like tweeting during the game. I was like, oh my God. Like, I can't even, it was crazy watching it as a non-fan of either team, but I can't even imagine, like, as a fan of either team.
No, I would have been throwing up if I was literally a fan of either team.
Yeah, but anyway, so follow Danielle on Twitter for occasional football commentary, apparently. So
totally went off.
During this time of the year.
Yes. And yes, if you like tweeting about TV shows and movies, which I do a lot of that too, I'm on Instagram at Danielle Sepp. I really just post pictures of my dog, so if you like cute dog photos, you can follow me there as well. And as for plugging, I did just recently write a piece for InStyle that's pretty fun and funny. If you'd like to read about playing a dead body on television, I wrote about that and interviewed the showrunner over at Law & Order SVU because apparently people pester him all the time begging to play a dead body on the show.
Yes, I read that. Was a lot of fun. I'm not like super, I don't really know anything about like this world, so that was very eye-opening for me. So, and very eye-closing for those dead bodies. So
very good pun.
Thank you. Awesome. Well, thank you guys so much for listening. As always, you can follow our podcast on Twitter at Cohen's Corner Pod. You can also follow me at NYMFan97, and you can follow Jake at Giblin_Jake. So hopefully we have some more actual baseball news to talk to you guys about in the near future. But until then, if not, we'll be musing over Mets stories from the days of yore, most likely. So thank you all so much for listening. And as always, let's go Mets. And thanks for stopping by.